Welcome, everyone. I'm Veronica Reyes Escudero, I'm Borderlands curator and librarian at the University of Arizona Libraries and Special Collections. First, I want to thank the Seminars Committee for giving us the opportunity to participate at this year's conference. I want to also thank our sponsor for the seminar, Liber Antiquus, Early Printed Books and Manuscripts. Your support is invaluable. If any of you are here, thank you so much. Before I introduce today's panelists, I would like to frame our discussion a bit by telling you a story. A couple of years ago, I was in the midst of fulfilling an interim department head assignment at my home institution when a good friend and colleague of mine, sitting over there, Athena, came to me as she was about to accept her first job as department head. As capable, perfect, and ready for the job as she was, she felt she shouldn't or wouldn't know where to start and asked me if I would share with her some kind of pathway on what to do. Where to start when she got there. What came to mind was a story in a book I read on Special Collections Management. I remember the scene of the author painted. And unfortunately, not much else. The author recalls his first day on the job. He remembers entering his new office with a large wooden desk and chair, and opening the desk center drawer to find a letter from his predecessor. Beyond that, I couldn't remember anything. I'd drawn a blank. My experience, of course, would be different than hers, as I saw my role as interim as preparing the department for our incoming director, and not necessarily setting long-term future direction for the department. Still, I wanted to help her. I wanted to hand a letter to her that provided some pathway to her first department head job. Turned out, she, of course, didn't really need it. However, with many of us necessarily possibly entering the ranks as department heads or starting to think about doing this, we thought it would be a great opportunity to offer a panel on what to do in your first year, your first years. From today's panelists, who come from a variety of institutional cultures and size, private and public institutions, you'll hear their experiences in coping with the first year as department head, relationship building, change management, navigating administrative politics, and hear from a seasoned perspective. We have four courageous colleagues ready to share with you what it's like to be the boss in their own stories. This session is for everyone, whether you're starting out in the profession or a seasoned professional looking to mentor those that are coming along. We will have about a 10-minute talk from each of the panelists, followed by a moderated Q&A, which we may shorten depending on the time. Our goal will be to end with a good 20 or so Q&A from the audience with the panelists. I'll now introduce all three panelists so you can get a sense of the variety of institutions they come from and the variety of experiences they come with. Amy Rushing, here, from the University of Texas San Antonio Libraries as Head of Special Collections. Her professional career has focused on metadata strategies and the digital preservation and access of unique primary source materials. She's currently the head of, like I said, sorry, I'm reading this. She supervises 10 archivists and librarians who curate paper and digital collections that document the history, legacies, and cultures of San Antonio and South Texas. Before coming to UTSA, she was head of digital access services at the UT Austin. Amy has also held positions at U of A and then University of Arizona, Palace of the Governor's Photo Archives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Crystal, who's university archivist at Brown University, she provides leadership and vision for the University Archives and Special Collections Department, a position she has held since August 2015. Prior to joining Elon, she was the director of archives at the J. Craig Venter Institute and Venture Congressional Archivist. There's a thing here. From the U of A. Sorry, I really did not plan this at all. She was a 2013 member of Archives Leadership Institute and member of the Academics Certified Archivist. Athena Jackson, chair and head of Eberly Family Special Collections Libraries at Penn State. It is the Dorothy Ford Huck Chair, and like I said, head of Eberly Family Special Collections Library. She sees five functional areas of operation, of this Special Collections Library. Curatorial services, research services, collection management, digital services, and university archives. She provides leadership.
That's about it.
That works.
Wherever she goes.
In the bathroom.
Wherever she goes. I'm having the income chair. She provides leadership in Special Collections and Archives maintained at the University of Commonwealth Campus Libraries in Manchester, the archival staff at the Cole and Coke Heritage Center at Penn State Fayette. She sets priorities for collection development for digital and physical special collections, identifies and initiates new collection areas in support of the university's evolving research and teaching mission, and works with the university libraries departments and staff to develop priorities, technical infrastructure, and workflows in support of an ambitious large-scale digitization goal for special collections. So you can see the variety of institutions. And then, of course, Thomas Hyrie, Florence Harrington, librarian of Houghton Library and Director of Arts and Special Collections at Harvard Cambridge Libraries, is responsible for the Houghton Collections and operations and leads an ongoing effort to expand the library's acquisition, curatorship, service, and outreach programs. Prior to his current position, he was Director of Special Collections at the University of California, Los Angeles. At UCLA, he oversaw the integration of 5 separate units into a single special collections department with 40 staff members. He also oversaw the library's long-range and annual plan, fundraising, and coordination of special collection services and programs with other library and campus groups. So in this case, in this panel, Tom is our seasoned department head. Without more introduction, I will go ahead and let the panelists speak again for about 10 minutes each. I'll watch the time, and then we'll follow with the moderated Q&A, shortened perhaps, and then Q&A with the audience. Thank you.
Hello. I feel really lucky that I get to tell my story after hearing Michaela. I'm just setting expectations. Okay, I've been working in libraries since 1999. I've held several different types of library positions over the years, including paraprofessional jobs before grad school. The bulk of my career up until now has been the digital side of archives. Though that's not what I originally intended to do when I began grad school. My first professional job was photo archivist, but I quickly learned that there may not be very many photo archivist positions available, which could potentially limit my professional development. And even though I loved being a photo archivist, I reinvented myself as an archivist focused on digitization, metadata, and digital archives. I had quite a bit of experience with those things in grad school, so it wasn't really a stretch. And I continued along that path until my current position as head of special collections. If you had asked me 5 years ago if I would be head of special collections now, I would have said no. No way. I was unable to see myself as a leader, and I just didn't think I had it in me. In 2013, I took a new position as digital archivist at the University of Texas San Antonio, and a few weeks after I started, the head of special collections resigned. It never occurred to me to apply for the position, but at the suggestion of my husband and the encouragement of my friends and other colleagues, I reluctantly applied. And I have to say, I was a bit terrified. I was half hoping I wouldn't get an interview. I struggled with self-doubt, I obsessed over my weaknesses, and I wasn't sure I could handle so much responsibility. Also, I just started as the digital archivist. Didn't it seem a bit presumptuous to apply for the head of special collections?
No.
Well, you know the results. I did get an interview and I did get a job. I'm convinced that nothing could have prepared me for transitioning to a department head. It's exactly like juggling, spinning plates, and playing ping pong all at the same time. In the beginning, I found it helpful to reflect on all of my past positions and institutions and think about the managers that I admired. And why were they effective managers? What did they do that I can adopt. I also thought about my past bosses that were not particularly effective and why. And in some ways, knowing the kind of boss I didn't want to be was more useful than knowing what kind of boss I did want to be. So my goal is to become a boss that I would want to have. From day one, I was faced with situations I'd never experienced, and in some cases had no idea how to respond. I put a lot of pressure on myself to know the answer to everything. This is ridiculous, of course, but I had convinced myself that if I were truly department head material, I would already know how to handle anything that came my way. Having this mindset, by the way, is exactly how you get ulcers. I eventually learned that there is no shame in asking questions. You don't know what you don't know, right? I learned that seeking advice from former colleagues I admire has been invaluable. Even seeking advice for things that seem so simple now. For example, one of my weaknesses coming into this job was that I had no donor relations experience whatsoever. Early on, I began developing a relationship with a local organization whose papers we were interested in acquiring. It takes time to build these relationships, and over the course of a year, my first year, I slowly built their trust. I had had a verbal agreement from them, but couldn't seem to move the process to the next level. So I called one of my former bosses, and I asked him, "Is there anything I should be doing, anything else?" And he said, "Invite the president of the organization to a nice lunch with you and the dean of the libraries. If you could get the president of the university, that'd be really great. Give them a tour, show them your facilities, and reiterate why their collection is important." He said, "You want to make them feel special because they are." And by the end of the lunch, we had a date to begin transferring the collection to Special Collections. While this strategy may not have worked in another donor situation, it worked in this one, and it made me realize that reaching out to those that have been in this game a while is a worthwhile effort. A little later, to expand my network for colleagues I could ask questions to, I started a Google group for heads of special collections in Texas. And it's been a very active, I think, Google group where we have new heads of special collections as well as seasoned special heads of special collections, and we ask questions of each other, and it's been really, really helpful. Also, in my situation, going from a colleague to a boss was awkward, to say the least. Trying to navigate a new relationship or actually building a different kind of relationship required diplomacy, self-awareness, and of course, humor. It meant that I didn't really have a honeymoon period. I knew these employees. I knew what their frustrations were. I even knew that some of them were unhappy with their job. I knew the institutions and the department's weaknesses. And in some ways, this was a huge advantage. But in other ways, it was a huge challenge. I had to figure out how to gain respect as a leader and to gain the trust of my new employees who were once my colleagues. It was important for me to mark the transition from a colleague to a boss, both for myself and for my new team. To feel like the boss, I found that I needed to shift my point of view. I was no longer an individual within a department. I was now the face of a department. I would no longer be a specialist, really, but in many ways, a generalist. I had to learn how to delegate and let my employees do their job. To help my team with the transition, I scheduled both one-on-one meetings and I held a retreat to talk about my vision. I asked for their input on what they felt would improve the department's operations, and I listened to their suggestions. I had heard about a SWOT analysis, and I thought it could be a good activity for the team to do together. And for those of you who don't know, SWOT refers to identifying a department's strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. The SWOT analysis helped me understand the landscape, and it helped solidify a new vision for our department. It has also been an extremely useful tool for advocating on behalf of the department. From my experience, being an advocate may be one of the most important skills you can develop. In my first year, I had to learn what that meant. Now I realize I am never not advocating for special collections. It requires articulating to the administration what your team needs to be successful. It means bragging about special collections to my boss on campus and out in the community. If you've never had an advocate, you know how damaging that can be to morale. In order to be an advocate, I had to know how everyone contributes to the team, what they need to be successful, what they do well, and how they support the mission of the library and the university. I quickly discovered also that I have to protect my employees from multiple demands. I know how stretched thin they are. It seems like I've done such a great job of bragging about them that everyone wants a piece of special collections. We are constantly being pulled in 1,000 different directions. Things are thrown our way weekly from the director of development, the dean, donors, librarians, the communications department, patrons, fundraisers, faculty, students, etc. I've had to learn how to gently push back without seeming like I'm being an obstacle. I want my team to be successful, not stressed out and exhausted, and I've had to learn how to gently say no, and in all of these cases, diplomacy has been my best friend. Getting buy-in is not as easy as it seems. Some of the biggest missteps I've made have been around getting buy-in. It's easy to assume that only big changes or big projects need buy-in, and this could be further from reality. Getting buy-in is an art, and I've discovered that some people need time to sit with an idea to come around to it. No one likes to be caught off guard, and everyone wants to feel they've had an opportunity to express their concerns and to provide feedback. I learned the value of a pre-meeting meeting. Some people also call this priming the pump. A pre-meeting meeting is actually a very effective way of increasing buy-in. It's an opportunity to meet with stakeholders individually to talk about the issue at hand. It's a chance to introduce your idea, learn how they will be impacted, hear their initial reactions and concerns, and to see things from their perspective. And I may even have to change the way that I'm thinking about my idea. So it's really good to get their perspective. So in hindsight, navigating that first year was not easy. There's so much more that I could say about this, but I'll let the other panelists share their stories. I had to push through that self-doubt. I had to get out of my comfort zone and discover strategies that will help me be the boss that I would want to have. I've grown professionally and personally, and to me, that's one of the most exciting things about moving into this role. I really do love my job. It's stressful, yes, but I love it. So I've learned that I do have it in me.
So yes to everything you just said. I'm like, if I'm not saying it within my part, like everything that Amy just said is exactly how I felt in my first few years at Elon. So, I'm Crystal Carpenter. I work at Elon University. It's a, they say mid-sized, but it's small. It's a small private liberal arts university in the middle of North Carolina. The archives really have just been around for 10 years. I'm the second professional archivist they've ever had. And so a little framing for the department. I have about five. I started with three employees, and we have about five employees now. And like Amy, you know, my becoming a boss really wasn't something that when I started in archives in 2001 was something I thought I was going to ever do or want to do. I say that I think it chose me. I didn't choose it. I mean, what seems to happen, and I mean, at least from my experience, is you, you're passionate about your job, whatever, wherever it may be. People see that. You want to be engaged. People take the opportunities to utilize you because you're a good employee, and slowly but surely more different roles come to be where you start doing leadership, and then you start realizing, oh, well, in my case, I kind of like this, so let's see where this goes. And so I jumped around different institutions to see the type of place I wanted to be. And I know that's not always possible for everyone, but I really did feel that I had the opportunity to kind of pick and choose and see what was the right fit, because if I would have taken this job without knowing some things about me and about the position, it might have turned me away from being a manager. So I think it's really important to make sure that you're interviewing your place, that you go in and feel that it's right so that you could be successful. So, you know, the transition happened slowly for me. You know, the more I stepped up, the more leadership happened. And so the adjustment, like Amy said, the adjustment from being a colleague to being the boss happened slowly, and it was something that going from that specialist to that generalist was kind of, it made you vulnerable. So there was either like fear or opportunity, and I chose to, you know, latch onto the opportunity aspect of it. You'll see in my talk, everything's a little, I'm a very optimistic person. So everything I'm talking about, like, yes, when you're head of the department, it's difficult. And, you know, I'm gonna kind of talk about things in like idealistic terms, but you know, there is pushback, give and pull, and you have to negotiate and say no and say yes. But generally you're gonna hear through here that, oh, it sounds all wonderful, butterflies and roses, but it's not, you know, it's real life. But, you know, so I, you know, the fear or the, you know, empowerment. So I kind of took it upon myself to reach out to colleagues and make that network to help me feel empowered in my role. And things like the Archives Leadership Institute was another amazing way for me to feel as though I was prepared for jumping into a leadership management type role. You know, finding your institutional fit is kind of like dating. You know, you have to know yourself. You know, it's like, what do you like? What don't you like? What can you live with? What can't you live with? And so you have to think about and reflect on who you are, I think, for you to be able to be a good boss. And I want to really reiterate what Amy said about, you know, I've seen good bosses and I've seen bad bosses, and I know what I really don't want to be like. I want to be that boss that I would have looked up to and said, that's what I want to be when I grow up. So, you know, so you have to, you know, do that self-reflection, I think. Now, I'm going to focus mostly on building campus relationships. So, you know, the university communications, advancement, development, the president's office, you name it. I'm just going to kind of generalize with working with those departments. So the one thing I'll say is that in my first year, anywhere that I've been, I am pretty, you know, I don't jump right in and do things that aren't fires. So I kind of take my time to get to know the institution, get to know my colleagues. I like to figure out what language they speak so that I could speak it back to them so that it resonates with them. So I take a little bit of time to kind of learn my environment. And by learning my environment, I feel like it's a strategy that allows me to be more successful. And also, you know, one of my weaknesses is I don't like conflict. So I try it all ways possible to find avenues that help me to keep that conflict at bay when all possible. So a lot of these strategies are going to talk about that type of way in which I operate. So learning the organizational culture, how they work. You know, Elon is very, it's a wonderful place to work. And they really are all about community. They're very unsiloed. Every Tuesday, faculty, staff, students, we get together for something called College Coffee, where everyone comes together, gets a free cup of coffee, donuts, and you get to sit there and interact with each other. So it's very much about building relationships. And so seeing that aspect of the culture, that's how I tried to operate. So, you know, I started at Elon and I got a budget to be able to take people to coffee or to lunch or to dinner and just start building those relationships. It wasn't about what can you do for me or how can we work together, but just tell me about your department and how have you worked with the archives before? Or are you interested in working in the archives? You know, just your story, build that collegial familiarity with each other, so that you can start to understand what synergies there might be between you and the different departments on campus. And I think you could find synergies with any department on campus that you're working with. You know, I work in an academic institution, and you know, the lay of the land is we follow our campus strategic plan. So everyone has the same, they have different goals and how they achieve it, but we all have one common goal. So if we can work together to figure out how me and another department like advancement might meet those goals, it's kind of like twice the win, because we're both doing something together that is going to benefit the institution and ultimately advocate on our behalf. So synergy is a very important aspect that I look for when working with other departments on campus. The collegiality, like, it's very important for me to, you know, just build those friendships so that they have a harder time saying no to me. or it's easier for me to say no to them, because I feel like we have built a relationship that is strong, that it doesn't matter if I turn down this one thing, because they'll understand the larger context because we're friends. And also, you know, it just helps to, you get to know the person, they get to know you. You don't know, you can't, I mean, Elon's not huge, but you can't know everything that's going on on campus and how the archives could possibly relate and benefit from something that someone's doing. But the more you work with one campus partner and the more they get to know you and your archives, the more likely they are to share it with other people and then go, oh, you know, there's this great project that so-and-so is doing. Would you be interested? And be like, oh, I have too much to do right now, but maybe, you know, in a couple of months I'll reach out or something like that. So, you know, there's all these ways in which it helps to build those relationships and partnerships and objectives and goals that you don't even know are out there until you do that. And then, like Amy said, advocacy. I think advocacy is the most important part of being the head of an archives. I mean, you know, and it's not just the external advocacy to the stakeholders, but, you know, it is your internal advocacy that you know, show that you do so your employees see it, your boss sees it, your boss hears it, the other departments on campus. And then also, you know, the more you teach, the more others are willing to share back and learn from what you're saying. You know, be willing to compromise when you're working with campus partners. You know, like I said, be willing to say no, but let them understand why you're saying no. You know, also be able to say yes, even if you don't see that there's a short-term return for you. You know, nurture these relationships for the long haul, not for the immediate need. I kind of think of relationships as, you know, when you think about digital projects, you know, it's not a project, it's a program. It's something that you want to have for your long term. So think of it holistically. And then, you know, I sometimes, you know, you're busy. Everyone's busy in your departments, but sometimes you know, take one for the team. You know, an example is I have a partner, our technology learning group, who, you know, we're working on a cross-campus video platform for managing our video assets. And it's just one of many projects that I know over time I'm going to work with this department with, because technology is important to archives and we're important to technology. So, you know, they do a project management training. I don't need to go do a half, you know, a 20-hour project management course with that department, because I have lots of things to do, but it's a good olive branch. Mm-hmm. So I did it. And it was great because it helped me to understand how they operate so that I could, again, speak their language. Perfect. So, you know, lastly, just to close, you know, the earlier you start reaching out to people at your university, the better. The sooner people know who you are, the sooner you can start those relationships. And, you know, when you're new to an institution, change happens whether or not you want it. You're new, so that's a change. And so being able to start off right away on a good, positive footing and be able to, you know, say, look, there's a new person, there's new opportunities, how can we do this together? The sooner that program can start to produce long-term results. So thank you.
Hello.
Hi.
My name is Athena Nicole de la Rosette Jackson, and I'm saying that because when I got the job at Penn State, I called my parents in Texas and said, "Dad, I'm the Dorothy Fuller Huck Chair and Head of the Special Collections Library." And it's, I used to get annoyed when people did that, the microphone at conferences, and I realized you're honoring that chair, you're honoring their support. And my dad said, "Well, then, De La Rosa, I'm your biggest donor. So you're going to start saying my name, whether it's hyphenated or not, Miss Hug Chair." So that is, I didn't hyphenate it, but this is an homage on recording. "Dad, I'll make you listen to this so you know that I said your name, and I didn't forget that you're my biggest donor." So I'm going to just dive right in, and I actually wrote my remarks as a Luddite on a computer, so for, as a left-handed person too, which is hard, I think, maybe. But so forgive me if I seem a little physically awkward. That's just, you know, comedy for your pleasure. The title of my little remarks is called "Change Management and the First Year: Why Would You Want to Do That?" Well, there will be many times when you walk into a leadership role in your special collections library where your executive library leadership may offer you the opportunity to make adjustments to the team you supervise in order to match the vision you're trying to implement. Or maybe your managers will apprise you that you're entering a setting that recently has undergone a reorganization, and the next logical step is to activate this newly designed structure. Or maybe your manager shared that the strategies of the larger library require some calibration with your own unit to fulfill short-term and longer-term goals set by the overall library strategic planning. Or in my case, they may tell you all three, and they may tell you this in your first month. That is, "Hey, match your team to your vision while activating your recent reorganization while also making sure that the outcomes match the strategic plan of the libraries." And you say, "Okay, I'll be right back." What do you do? It's been 1 month, and you now start setting your planning, and at this point, you realize you haven't even put to memory where everyone's desk is, much less what their priorities are, so you're ready to go. So I'm speaking to you from the tail end of what was really a 3-year reorganization set forth by my predecessor quite well, and I refined it by my own efforts and vision that started March of 2016, and we fully activated, almost fully, I'm sure some of my colleagues will hear this, this spring. So I'm hoping to impart to you 3 takeaways I have from my experience, and I'll happily expand upon any of these in the Q&A. Number 1, define the ways that you'll make decisions. And I chose mine with a little alliteration: views, informed, influenced, or inspired. And informed decisions are born from the countless conversations, one-on-ones, like Amy mentioned, small groups, large group meetings, charged task force or working groups, I'm such an ALA girl, tackling a topic and providing a formal report and walking through your spaces, be present. If you read any Harvard Business Review, they always say the best leaders are the ones that walk around that your team sees. You don't hide in your office, you know, get out there. And I wear heels, so they hear me clip-clopping down the hall all the time. Take notes as they're talking to you, and while you're talking to them, start to share your vision. Share it informally, casually, when you run into them, when you're asking what they're doing, and be as transparent as possible. When I was having my one-on-ones, I created a post-it city. So as I was talking one-on-one, I have this whiteboard in my office, and I would write charged phrases, not, you know, accusatory or, you know, one person, but just, you know, things like security, processing plans, accession workflows, AL metrics, you know, and these are not my words. These are things that were born from these one-on-ones. So I put them up on my whiteboard throughout all of the first month and a half of one-on-ones with each team member, and then left them there. And they could go in there and look at those, and they can see what everybody's saying to me, because, ooh, what are they saying to the new boss? And what is she writing down? What's resonating with her? And I also did this other thing with getting them into small groups to grapple with specific points of our work, from access to discovery to instruction. And we even did a small group called Internal and Administrative Filing Systems, and then one called Student Job Descriptions Review. Everyone had a role to play, and I purposely didn't use the org chart to make this, so it didn't matter where you sat. You could be the chair of one of these groups, and even your boss could be sitting right in there as a member of this group. And I really wanted people to feel like they owned the dialogue, particularly when all they were charged to do was make recommendations. No one was given, like, you can change everything. All they wanted to do was start dialogues, and I couldn't do that with 20-something staff in my first month, so I really wanted to empower them. The second kind of decision is called influenced decisions, and those are derived from peers outside of your local group, so those are like the heads of cataloging, preservation, access services, learning and teaching, subject specialists, lectors, facilities, our best friends, right? And those influence decisions can also be directly given to you by your leadership and their impressions when you ask, how are you going to measure success of my team? Manage up, share with your new boss your ideas, test the waters on what you think is innovative so that you understand the scope of larger or any legacy concerns. And I love this phrase, I'm sure that Tom will hear some resonance across this days, is to get buy-in and support at the front end and always ask for advice. And I mean that across all of your conversations. I think as you're building your leadership role, find a place, hear an expertise, tease out a talent, and then ask for advice on it. Be authentic, because you really do want to know what it is that they are really passionate about. Get some advice from them, like, I have never done that before. I haven't taught since I was at Miami. How do you do that? You know, say those things so that they can start to feel empowered about what you're doing. This third type of decision is called inspired. And I like this one because it's simply why you were hired. You passed the institution's fitness test. I cannot believe I passed Penn State's fitness test, but I guess I did. And then just be you and do you. I know that sounds a little cliche, but those of you who get it. Like, don't stop being you. You know, and if you is someone who feels cautious and nervous, I actually say, like, I'm walking in here in a state of vulnerability. Please know this before I even have this meeting with you. Let's take our hats off and tell me what you really think about this. You know, accept that you're going to get serious constructive criticism and take it. You've been asked to enter this setting as a leader. You've been risen to a leader. That sounds very biblical. And you earn trust and you build your knowledge. Identify all of your champions. There's that one or two. I know a new colleague who's a leader here now, and one of her staff members already fangirls about her and loves her. And, you know, she has a champion. She may not even know this, right? Find your champions and assuage the concerns of your skeptics by always telling them that you can hear more, that you can understand more. And what I would recommend in that first year is really stay centered on short-term successes. Don't forget that your inspiration will be influenced and informed in the many ways as time goes by while you're activating your network and building your vision. But it will also be, it also basically means what you bring to your role. Ask yourself these questions when you're initiating change, and you might have heard a little bit of this already. What work environment do you want to work in? What types of output do you want to see coming from your team's collective work? And what inspires you to come to work every day, and how is that realized in your actions? Ask yourself that, because then you can model it much more authentically. Look, I want to come to work to have a good day. I'm from a working class barrio. I like it that my kid has had medical insurance. You can't ruin my day yet. So, you know, that's how I roll. The second kind of learning moment that I wanted to share, takeaways, is communicate in a variety of ways and communicate often. So I try my best to, I'm glad nobody, I don't think anyone that works at Penn State is here, but.
It's being recorded.
Oh, great. I try my best to offer a regular, and I call it a Friday fortnight, but I admit it's been called Friday fortnight-ish. And sometimes I allow myself a monthly musing, you know, get the literate in there, during your peak work times, like if you're in budget season or personnel review time. And I use this to communicate big picture and sometimes just forming ideas that I have with the team. I share things I'm reading, cool things I saw, and to spotlight some accomplishments. And in full disclosure, I'm behind on my Fortnite update right now, so I'm going to share these remarks with my colleagues right after this meeting and say, this is what I said. So even if they're not here, they're going to read it. So I look forward to them tweeting out everything I said wrong. Hopefully good. So communication also means saying thank you. Your team is going through a lot of change, and they probably went through a lot of change just to build what your job is now. Maybe they're like, oh, this is the kind of head we need now. Sorry, you're not doing this anymore. We're going to give it to the head, and that person's going to meet you at your interview and be like, hi. So, you know, they're going through a lot of change before you got there. They're going through change you get there. So thank them for their patience and resilience and their humor. of their water cooler moments, of just hanging in there. All of this is important to demonstrating that you understand that the change is not just the stroke of a key or the move of an office, but it basically is actively replacing many years old habits. Really thank them for that, because they will appreciate that, I would offer. Communication as advocacy, I think you heard this as well, I like that word. As the year goes by, the rest of the library is still working, just so you know. So you need to remind your bosses and your peers and your stakeholders that your team is going through change. Remind them regularly in ways that are conducive to your communication channels. So when you have a meeting with your boss, say, I want to add one more agenda item, updates on task force, or update on special collection strategic plan. And that's a way to share positively the changes that are happening and protect your team from too many expectations as all of our habits are starting to gel. My third takeaway is that change management can also mean changing the work culture. You may be breaking down some structures, adding new responsibilities, distributing work differently, and introducing more efficiency workflows, among many, many other things. This all means that the way the team interacts is going to change too, and it could change the culture of how your group feels as a community. And be really conscious of that and empathetic to that shift. So that's my big three, and I assure you that I was not perfect. I believe, and I say this often, that my worst days are when I sense that my colleagues are feeling overwhelmed, under-resourced, or ill-informed. That is a bad day for me. And another bad day is when someone's like, what is she doing all day, right? They should really know what you're doing all day. And if they don't, you need to find a way to tell them, because they are wondering, trust me, they're wondering right now what you're doing here right now. I endeavor to correct all of my mistakes as best as I can. And I'm conscious that with my authority comes equal responsibility. I'm responsible for the environment in which my colleagues can work and feel a sense of pride and success and also challenge. So, when I first started, I sometimes felt like those classic stories of the unknown salesman coming to town to offer a new product that could change the entire population for the better. Or if you watch The Simpsons, the monorail song. Please Google that. And my goal was not to sell a vision, but to get investment. And it doesn't stop in your first year. And I hope the new models we set at Penn State of organization and workflows and interactivity will surface new challenges for me. I'm excited for the future. And as we all know, change is inevitable, but it doesn't have to be altogether painful. Thank you.
My father was a school superintendent and so had some leadership responsibilities himself, and he developed a series of aphorisms about leadership that were on the sarcastic side, but one of the things he used to like to say is what leaders do is they figure out where the crowd is going and then they run to get out in front of them. In other words, I should have spoken first this morning. I didn't prepare remarks because I thought my role would be to listen and try to synthesize, and so that's what I'm going to try to do, and you know, maybe add a few words of my own. I thought I would share my own background really quickly as an exemplar, because I share a lot of what was reported on earlier by my fellow panelists. And there's a through line about leadership. So I was a really good archivist in my first job. I started supervising archival processing, and I got a great job at the Beinecke, managing the manuscript unit there. From there, I went to UCLA, where I ran my own program, and I've since gone to Harvard, where not only do I run Houghton Library, but I'm also the director of something called the Arts and Special Collections of Harvard College Library, which is a unit that combines Houghton with the Fine Arts Library, the Music Library, and the Film Archive. So I talk about this because in each of these settings, I think that this is a common journey, you go from what you know really well into another level where you're managing things that for which you have some expertise, and then a wide group of things for which you have little to no expertise. And that flip is this really important I lived in California for 4 years, so I think I can say journey. You know, part of a, you know, it's a part of a leadership journey, right? And in fact, it's been written about. If you're at Harvard, people run around quoting the Harvard Business Review all the time. There is really important set of work by a woman named Linda Hill that I would encourage people at this stage of their career to read. And what Linda Hill talks about is the difficulty in the transition from being what is known as a star performer to a manager and a leader. And in the world of the star performer, you know the work, you become an expert, you talk to other experts, you're valued for that expertise, you judge yourself by it, and it's a really great, you know, it's a really great part of a career. And to be honest, I miss that that part of my career some. When you start taking on more and more responsibility, you don't have the time to invest to get expertise, you know, around along all aspects of a broad portfolio. So the work becomes less about what you know and more about your ability to synthesize and to communicate to others. And that flip is hard because we identify ourselves early in our career with what it is we know and our own expertise. And the idea that you kind of have to let go of that thing that you have built and you care about and spend far less time with it than you ever did is a really difficult but absolutely essential journey. I thought I'd share a few fallacies that about leadership that I heard come up earlier. The first is the leader's a person who knows the most and always knows the best, right? So if you think of yourself in a leadership position is that you have all the answers to every question, you're not going to get very far. And by the way, if your staff thinks that you're the person who has all the answers and knows the best all the time, you aren't going to get very far. What good, effective leadership leaders do is recognize, cultivate, and appreciate expertise in others. There's also a fallacy that when you get into a leadership position, you have more control. And to an extent, that is true. I, you know, maybe modeling my own father, I sometimes say, you know, part of what I love about my job is I occasionally get things the way I want it. But it is occasionally, right? Because we live in, and we work in social ecosystems that are made up of a complex set of individuals who, and let's face it, we don't work in the military, right? And it's not always a a giving orders sort of situation. So like my panelist said, you have to get buy-in and you have to win hearts and minds a lot of the time. And then I really liked this theme that came up, and this is a really important point that once you get into the position, you're supposed to be fully formed and know all the answers. So when I have moved myself into new leadership positions and when I hire, you hire for potential. You hire for potential and ambition. So you look at somebody and you say, she can hold down some of this job and she has the ability to grow into the rest of it over time. If you go into the position thinking, I have to be the, if you look at somebody who, say, you have worked for who is fully formed, it will eat you alive, as my panelist said. Now, I bring that up as a really important thing because that value often runs along gendered lines. So men are more likely to say, I'll take a risk. You know, like, I can do some of this, I'll take a risk. And, you know, and the research has said that women are less likely to do that. And, you know, I'm a white man up here saying, like, I want to call that out as a dynamic. And, you know, and I really want to encourage, you know, all people who think they have it in it to think that way. Because the truth is, this would be true of any job. You wouldn't want to move into something unless it was a challenge to you and an opportunity to grow. So leadership positions are no different. I thought I'd end with a few attributes that occurred to me as my co-panelists were talking. Optimism, Crystal, you know, I think, first of all, I think you have to, on some level, be truly optimistic. And even in your bad moments, you have to act optimistic because people look to you. That is what people look to leaders for, right? How to react about something. I wrote down self-awareness and humility. And I think it's really important to know and understand your own weaknesses. Crystal, you said this thing about being uncomfortable with conflict. That's certainly true. I am as well. But I'll tell you, I'm more comfortable with it than I was 5 years ago. and 5 years ago, I would have said the same thing. Uh-huh. You know, I've identified it, you know, I've worked on it, and it's about getting better. So anyone in any position would bring some natural attributes to it, understanding what your strengths are and what your weaknesses are, and then actively working to get better on your weaknesses while forgiving yourself for the fact that you may never not get super great is just really important. That feeds into something you can maybe tell I'm about to say. Managing one's own emotions is incredibly key leadership. And so that what I just said about forgiving yourself for not being great at everything, no one is. And my experience, both for myself and the people I work with, the best people I work with, is that they hold themselves to this incredibly high, high bar that would be impossible to actually accomplish. And being able to forgive oneself for not hitting aces all along is super important. I really like that Veronica opened this by saying courage, you know, because I think all of, you know, courage undergirds all of these things. You have the ability to take risks, the ability to put yourself out there. And then, you know, the stuff about authenticity is so true. And I heard people say, I am going to model my own behavior on my best supervisors. I would modify that a little bit because you can't be your best supervisor, right? You can say, that really worked well in one circumstance, this worked well in another circumstance. You have to weave those things in to make it your own practice, because the moment you start trying to be somebody you're not, we as human beings smell that on others in a minute. So I would like to join with my panelists and say, to put a positive spin on taking leadership positions. The reasons to do it, you know, it's an opportunity for personal growth. You do get to push your own vision forward. Assuming these responsibilities does give you really important opportunities to pursue your own vision, your own values. You know, I have a lot about values from Athena. You can have a positive impact on others. And then it is in this, if you go into a leadership, you know, and this is the last thing I'm going to say, if you go in thinking all of those other things, you know, like I get to have my vision, my values, and my, you get it wrong. Because what leadership is at its very core, its very root, is its service. And the truth is that if you believe in the work that we are doing as a profession, as a library, as an archive, then taking on this responsibility is the way to serve that calling. And so in this room where I know we've got a mixture of very, I guess I'm seasoned, but very, very seasoned leaders and administrators and people, you know, through people who are earlier in their career, I would just encourage all of you to see yourself in a new light and take those risks. So thanks.
We don't know what we did. We might have turned it off.
I want to check the temperature for a second here, because we are entering the moderated Q&A, but can I see a show of hands of people who have questions right now that are burning, so I can measure the time that we might need? And I know that more will come up as we talk, maybe. So, okay, so I'll take a few minutes to do a little moderated. I think we took a lot of lessons today, which Tom has so succinctly and nicely summarized for us. But there were a couple of things that came up, I think, during the conversation that we expound on a little bit. It might take a little bit of a case study situation to learn from. So one of the things that I heard from Amy early on was that during your pre-meetings, you might have gotten ideas, right, your lead ideas to go in and listen. Were there, was there a time when you went in firmly with an idea you had, and others can answer too, not just me, but was there a time when you really had to, you know, switch what you were thinking while you were meeting your employees and ideas that they had?
Yes, particularly with new procedures. With 10 employees, everyone has a different perspective. A procedure may work for one person, but not for another. And always have, it can be challenging to balance what one person on the team wants and the other person on the team wants. Obviously, compromise, you have to compromise always. But getting people on board with compromise, while you might not get exactly what you want, but how about we do this? Kind of trying to listen to what their concerns are, and then seeing if you can adjust or modify the approach. I've encountered that on several different occasions.
I would say it also helps with the empowerment of the staff, with your employees. So, you know, you might come in with this idea, but you're not the one that's going to be necessarily doing the work. So being able to, like, start by having the conversation instead of bringing the idea to them, to say, hey, like, what I try to do is, like, I know we have this big project coming up, and before I make any decisions about it, why don't you tell me what you think about it? And then we could go tweak, you know, what works for me and what works for them, and then go from there.
I think I should,
give a specific
because I will give an example. I talked about my worst day, maybe I can talk about a best day. I always have a very, I'm very WYSIWYG, right? I mean, those of you know that more well than you probably need to. But I tell people that my idea of a really good conversation is when you come to me and say, here's the problem and here's a suggested solution. I would rather them come in with, even if that solution is like, and it's going to cost you $5,000, or we're going to need to hire a part-time person, or Athena, you're going to have to let this go and die on this hill or battle with this. You know, and so to me, that best day is when I get a lot of solution-driven meetings that come from somebody else's expertise. And really, the example is when I was in this meeting, we were talking, my growing strength is in archives, although everybody knows I kind of sort of out in the rare bookie land of things I still love and cherish, but I have one of the largest archives in the country. So it's exciting to hear my colleagues push the envelope of archival practices and ask me, what if we did this, and how? And I'm like, man, that sounds like a big recon. I'm like, so what? You know, we have to do this. And even me, who wants to push the envelope, is still looking at those metrics of resources and cost. But I'm like, really, to me, once I hear that big suggestion that might be something I wasn't ready to go there with, I flip into, okay, how can I get the funding for this from the dean? How can I turn this into a story that she will say, yeah, I want to invest in that, and what, where can I hitch my wagon to the strategic plan, and then come in like, here's the strategic plan, and how we're going to meet it right here. And that person has a success. And I will say that the archival recommendations has really shaped my own advocacy for inclusion and diversity in such a fine way, because I work with 7 professional archivists who are so driven to change and mold.
I have a really similar way of thinking to it. You know, Athena, we must like sit in between the next time the next question they come. So I think when you think about planning and you think about getting staff input, I guess, as I said, one of the real benefits about being in a leadership position is you have this opportunity to push your own ideas. And we all have ideas. And as you would go into some sort of planning initiative, of course, you are going to bring your own ideas forward and through. I always go into one, with that being said, I always go into an exercise like that with the assumption that I'm going to learn something or hear something I didn't know, I'm going to learn that is going to change my own ideas and vision. And so that is kind of a way of having it both ways, but it's really true.
I'll try to stand closer, I guess.
Let's see. I think, Athena, you mentioned something about being willing to listen to authentic criticism or some, you know, real criticism, serious criticism. Was there something that any of you heard that was probably hard, but that sort of either changed behavior or direction or...
I love criticism. Maybe because I'm the youngest of five, and they love to critique me. But at my former job, I'll start there. I asked in the midterm, you know, the mid-year evaluations. I know they didn't plan this. I want to hope they didn't. But I asked each one of the three people who reported, like, what can I do differently? You know, not just thinking like, oh, you know, you could send an email with bullets. You know, something that was something that could change pretty easily. And without exception, all three of them like, Athena, we love it, but you're an early person, you're an early bird, and I don't want to talk to you at 8:30. I don't want your excitement between 8:15 and 9. I'm like, shut up. You know? You're like, and that's my energy state. Like, imagine me like now, imagine at 8 in the morning on any day, I'm running up and down the hall. I'm so like, look what we can do today. This is so exciting. See this book, da da da. And they're just like, I don't know, Athena. And so I had to understand that my circadian rhythm has to be, we all have to get that together, right? Because one of them is really enthusiastic after lunch, you know, and I needed to think about a sweet spot for us to communicate where everybody's, this is my alive moment. And when you're the supervisor, you're kind of being charged to align into their alive moments, because as Tom said, you want that investment of their work, you know. So that was the hardest thing for me. And ask anyone who's been my roommate at an RBMS, I wake up at 5 in the morning, I go to the gym, I have this little thing, so you don't want to be my roommate. And that's why you never see me after hours, I'm asleep at 9. But that early morning thing, and kind of like a personal critique that I pushed back on, right? One of them I pushed back on was, I as Tom alluded to, there's a gender issue in our field and in just management writ large, and don't mistake friendliness for weakness. Don't mistake passion for some kind of female hysteria, and do not mistake and I don't know, which means I don't know nothing, you know. So let's not do those three things. And I have to kind of hook somebody up for that and be like, no, actually, I'm not being whatever it is you think you are. I'm being the leader who wants to flip a script on this, and I need your investment. And I have had to ask, not in, I won't say which setting, but since I've worked in so many places, I don't have to say where, someone to, would you have asked me that if my predecessor had said this to you? You know, I had to say that because I'm the first brown woman to be at X place doing Y thing, you know, and there's a lot more of us in this room, you know, surfacing to do that. But it's important to check someone on their implicit bias. Thank you, Petrina, for teaching me what that means, because it's there. We all have it. And in the work culture that's so homogenous, sometimes you need to check it from a place of authority, because that's, you earned it. You really did.
That was spectacular. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
So I have been told I swear too much. That was an incredibly important piece of feedback. I've been told that sometimes in meetings, when I'm still working, when I'm in front of the room and I'm still working out what I want to say, my voice might trail off a little bit. And that's both hard to hear and not projecting enough. I had a supervisor once who wrote a very positive review of me, but there were these, the behaviors you get rated on, and one of the behaviors was flexibility, he wrote something like, you can tell I remember this, right? He was like, Tom likes to make a plan and stick to it. However, sometimes things come about and, you know, he needs to exhibit more flexibility. And so, you know, he wrote tons of other really good things. That's the thing I remember. I went home and complained about it to my wife. And I said, can you believe that he, you know, wrote that, you know, I'm not flexible. And she got really quiet. And I learned something.
Thanks for sharing. I would say the hardest one for me has happened in the last few months. Maybe that's why it's so raw, but and it goes well with me talking about building relationships. I had one colleague who, like one employee who was like, I don't think you're out there enough. They don't know who you are. And I was like, you know, and so at first I took that really hard and I was like, but I had to step back and think, where is she coming from? She is she is super extroverted. She has been there for 15 years, she knows, you know, everyone and anyone. Like, you ask her to do something, you're like, here, be in the front row to say hello to every single person. So she's coming from it in a different kind of setting and thought process. So I couldn't take it as a real criticism. I kind of looked at it and thought where she was coming from. And then I thought, okay, well, what I need to do is show her in other ways in how I am doing it, so that she doesn't necessarily, so that maybe she could understand where I'm coming from and how I do it also. So that was difficult, but I don't think it was like a harsh critique. I think it was just a comment that you know, came from a different kind of perspective than how I operate. So.
So quickly, Special Collections. We're in three different locations. We have staff in the library where our reading room is. We have staff in another offsite location. I would say the majority of the staff are over there. That's where the archives are. And then another location with another reading room in a totally different part of town. And this has been extremely challenging for me. It's been extremely challenging for the employees, because communication, morale building, feeling like you're really a team is hard when you're spread out all over the place. So I've tried really hard to find out in my one-on-one meetings, are you feeling disconnected? Is there anything I can do? I worry that because you guys are off in this other building that's not in the library, that you're feeling maybe a little left out, because donors come through the library, they get tours, and so the people who are over in the main library get more exposure. And I would say that a lot of times people think those are the only employees we have, are the three people that are there. Even I'm not, my office is not in that area. So anyway, I try really hard to do that in my one-on-one meetings. Thought that, okay, this is good, I'm trying to support them, showing them that I'm trying to support them in any way that I can, what can I do better? Until one day I get an email, a collective email from all of the employees that work in the offsite building about the challenge. To me, when I first read it, it felt like it was just this litany of complaints. And they did have suggestions for what we could do to solve those problems. And it did hurt, because I thought, wow, I thought I was giving them the opportunity in a one-on-one setting to explain this to me, but maybe they felt like it's will have more impact if they tell me together. So we ended up having a meeting about it. Now we have more regular meetings on the main campus to get everybody together. But yeah, that was hard, but it ultimately it was awesome, and now things are a little better than that. But communication is hard, keeping everybody up to date, up the chain, down the chain, and especially when you have people spread out across multiple locations.
Thank you, everyone. So I think I'm gonna go and do the Q&A from the audience. We don't have a microphone out there to pass around, so if you don't mind speaking up your question, and then I'll hand the mic to the moderator.
You raised your hand first.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle Dudley. I work at Emory University. I have a question sort of about, or maybe a want to get advice about perception. Perceptions about leadership. I am always very conscious that I am a black woman that looks very young. And so I'm just wondering how we are in a profession that is changing and people are embracing diversity, but what sort of advice or maybe even experiences that you've had related to sort of the things that you present to people sort of maybe physically as a sort of barrier to your role as a leader?
Can I answer before?
Yes. I'm going to pass that to her.
That was one of my burning questions that I decided not to ask. So I'm really happy that you asked it. I think, you know, I mean, just as an example, you know, you are very who you are, and things that I, one of the questions, and you talked about vulnerability, but there's a sense that, and we're changing, and hopefully that will be more understood, you know, it's as a person who kind of carries their her insecurities on her sleeve, you know, but knowing my stuff as well. But you know, but that's me, and that's my authentic me, and I wear boots and whatever. Mm-hmm. And so, I wonder how you answer this question, please. I'm
very. This is a great question. I also look very young. I'm in my 40s, and people think I'm a student. Now that I'm in my 40s, I absolutely appreciate it. But it's frustrating because, you know, you want to demand respect. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to sound really funny or silly, but the blazer is my best friend. I feel like the blazer is kind of it's a signifier, it can be a signifier of, okay, this is a person who's at least in a management role. It makes me feel like a leader. And when you feel like a leader, that comes through to people. And so that's my trick.
I wish I had the young thing. No, I'm just kidding. You know, there's been an instance where I was working, when I first was starting out, I was working in a reading room, and the person came up to the desk, and there was me and my gray-haired old male colleague, and the person came to me, or came to the front to ask a question, and they were like, no, I want that person. And I'm like, I'm really actually the better employee to ask about this question, you know? And so I just basically was like, you're getting me, and I'm going to help you, and we're going to work through this. So sometimes I just swallow it and just like move forward and just let them form their own conclusion on it. Other things I've done, I've had a donor recently who wasn't very excited that I was the female head of something, and there was a group of us having this conversation, and he kept trying to divert and kept looking at my older male counterparts for the advice and the you know, what he was looking for when I was the one saying it. And my colleague counterpoints basically were, you know, they reiterated, she is the one who will know what she is saying, and you listen to her. And so I was very thankful that they had the perception to say those things in front of me with the donor, and I just reiterated afterwards to the people, thank you so much, because it was a strange, I didn't know what to do at that moment, and they really helped me out there, so, I don't know.
Oh, Gabrielle, I'm so glad you're here. Let's see, you asked about being a woman of color in a leadership position. One kind of story I can tell opaquely to protect all of the participants was a situation where I was representing my institution, and an external important person said, with all due respect, we need someone more important than you. And I turned around and I said, I'm so glad you respect me, because I'm here to represent the institution. You know, you got to turn their words around. It's very much a kind of, maybe because I was in debate all through high school, you know, it's this sort of linguistic shifting that you're doing or something like that. It's really important that the Michelle Obama, you know, go higher, man. You know, just be who you were hired to be. And I'm not being political here. I just like what she said in that moment. And but I do remember the advocates, the support that you get. When I first started at Penn State, our curator of books walked me through the exhibit space, and one of our austere faculty was walking through, and he comes through. And she's like, oh, it was like my second week. She's like, I want you to meet Athena Jackson. He's like, is this your new intern? And she's like, good God, no, she's my boss, and we're so grateful she's here. She is like the most famous woman in her field. Like, she wouldn't stop. Like, she made me, like, I was floating on a cloud, and I was walking off. And then all of a sudden, he's like, well, we should get together. And he says this to me, and she's like, you need to talk to her assistant. Like, she made me like, you can catch me in a hallway. You're going to have to find time with her. And I love that about her, because that really helped me feel like I didn't know what to say to this very tall white man who's very well known in his field. I'm like, well, I'm actually the head of special collections. Nice to meet you. So, and I don't have a sartorial suggestion other than dressed in a way that makes you feel comfortable, makes you feel like you can be who you are. I think... I turn off NPR, and whatever comes on Pandora decides my outfit for the day. So sometimes it could be Tupac, and sometimes it could be Loretta Lynn. You never know who's going to show up at the door. But that's just who I am, right? So be you, again, that's really what I have to say.
What did you listen to this morning?
This morning, David Faulds was sleeping, so we're not romantic, but he was sleeping, and I just said, "Would I look good in this dress?" And he's like, "I don't care, Athena. I was out all night." No, he wasn't. David, I'm sorry. I love you.
I think what I would add, what I would add to this is
what
the
could you possibly add. Well,
I think I'm going to add a really important. Yeah, I mean, I would say I hear you. And those of you who are managers and are leaders and find yourself in positions of institutional power, it's incumbent on us to see the whole person in front of you. So,
amen.
Thank you.
I'll just want us to leave it here for the question. Mm-hmm. Totally. I think I think one of the most important things, and this is something in the literature too. My brother works in finance, and he works with super high, you know, powerful people in Wall Street, and then in Europe, and then Southeast Asia. He won the financial measuring stick of our family opportunity scope. He always told me that in the meetings, and he was saying this from a gender perspective, and I was actually excited about this. I never heard a businessman tell me something like this. He said, in most of our meetings, no matter how powerful the woman is, she always starts with the phrase, I think, da 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 da. And he's like, and then you hear the guy, he's like, we need to do this. This needs to happen. And one of the things, that could be across gender lines. We're in a gender fluid universe right now, and I don't want to discount that, but there's that self-doubt you might have when you're not the person in power, and like you were talking about, but you have the expertise. So when it's something that you know, and there's no doubt, like, this is actually the right solution, don't qualify it, don't ask if you can bring it up, just in the scope of your role, say, I'm so glad I'm at this meeting because I can provide you some input that can make this project move further. Here's what we should do. Boom, boom, boom. Rather than, I think, just saying, as this person, I know you're empowered. Like, don't do that. You know, just do it. You have the expertise. And my colleagues say that to me all the time. And I love that they've stopped the caveat and turned on the expert. Because as Tom said, we're just cultivating these experts. So managing up is making sure that your managers know when you're being the expert, right? And when you're really curious, like, but be the expert that time, and you will start to see those opportunities rise, and then, again, of course, ask for them.
That's a good question. Somebody wants to add to that.
Yeah. So for those of us
who don't apologize for everything or who are confident asking questions. We also are often seen as too aggressive. So
again, don't apologize, yeah. Don't mistake my femininity for not having power.
Right, so really, keep it going, stay strong, you know. That's so hard to say to you, right? At the conference, we're all in, like, you know, special collections camp, right? You still have to go home and do your chores and do all those things. But taking some of that energy, and Gabrielle and I have established a great bond, and a lot of you in here, and call your friends. Like, poor Veronica, she has to write me a letter every week. Call your friends, tell them what happened, like, find a place to diffuse it, and then keep doing you, you know? But if you need to share that, like, find your people and say, hey, I said this today, and then your best friend says, right on, keep saying it, because I'm going to say it over here, too, and while you're over there, we're going to keep doing this together.
Yeah, and this is obvious, probably already done, but, you know, talk to your supervisor. Say that you're interested in taking on some new opportunities and challenges and see where that goes. And if there isn't the opportunity in your institution, you know, it's, you know, get involved professionally. And it never fails where if it's a regional or a national, you volunteer to do something or you have the idea, like, they'll put it all on you and you'll have to do it. So I mean, just put yourself out there if it's not within your organization, within the profession and somehow.
Could I follow up on that question actually and ask you to dig a little deeper? So as administrators, and you must have people who try to manage up to you, can you speak to what's been effective, what's really helped you in that process that people here might take?
I'll say three things. First of all, it's all middle management.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, you think you get into the position where you, and then all of a sudden, a new layer reveals itself. So, yeah, swear to God.
That was your staff over there.
All right.
Stick to the plan.
Right, yeah. I had a three-point plan to address. Second is, you know, don't bring only problems, bring solutions. So you frame problems and say, yeah, we're really struggling with this. Here are some thoughts I have to solve it. And then the best piece of advice I've ever been given about managing up. So I have people bringing me problems or ideas, or I will make a decision and they don't like it, right? So because the impact of that decision has made things from where they sit in the organization worse for them. So the best people who manage up don't say, you know, and generally I will know that, right? You know, it's like you are when you're making difficult decisions, you're balancing different parts of your organization. There's very rarely a decision that's 100% great for everyone. So and good administrators weigh various concerns. So, you know, when I make a tough decision, I can kind of expect person X to come and bring a complaint. And so the best piece of advice I ever got was from somebody who was above me that said, look, when you're saying this, like, if I were you, I would feel the exact same way about this decision that I have made. And I understand that. Until you can tell me why I should, from where I sit, make a change my mind, then we really don't have as much to talk about. So that's that next level. Thinking about your managers, your supervisors as real people, thinking about what they value, what motivates them, and trying to work within that framework as much as you can. You know, those are some advice from me.
One last question.
Can I have to mention just really quickly?
Oh, sure.
I'm not a panelist, but I do want to address this question, because one thing that has helped me a lot in my career has been to remind myself occasionally that my boss has a boss. And they have expectations on them, they have problems that they're trying to solve for their leadership, and sometimes that impacts how I share information or how I position information or how I present solutions to the folks that I need resources from, or that I need support from, or that are in a position to make decisions that will impact me and the work that I do.
One last question.
At the very back.
Yeah, the very
back.
Yeah.
Right, I can't see that far.
I want to know about boundaries.
But now we're curious.
We have time for two more questions.
Yeah.
Anna Franz Beinecke, sort of staying on this theme, I'm fairly new in managing and I'm trying to find the balance between advocating for and protecting my people and not getting, but also keeping my eyes on the larger goals, on the larger picture, and not getting sucked into the weeds and sometimes drawn. So, any thoughts, advice?
So your question's about advocating for your colleagues to protect them while also managing up yourself?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So, I always like to say when we get into these points where I think the drama starts, honestly, and I'm not all interpersonal, we're all people, we all have our little habits. I don't like to hear that person eat a banana, those kinds of things. But interpersonal things aside, the drama is truly born from this moment in the day or the week or the month where you think, where you're acting like you live in that aspirational world, right? Rather than accepting that you're in the reality you're in, trying to build steps to that aspirational world. But we love that aspiration. We all want to be there, right? We all want to be there where Robin can ask a question and not care if someone cares if she is on their toes, right? And we want to be in those universes so that we can grow as people. We're trying to get there. So establish a reality check with your team as much as you can in those moments. Like, okay, listen, this is where we're not, this is a hill that we're not going to die on, and we're going to keep moving forward in these other ways to demonstrate our value to get to this aspirational universe. And that's a lot of soft skill rather than actual action. And so cultivating that soft skill, the best way where it comes from you authentically is what I would recommend. It's really hard. It's so hard to tell your team. I went upstairs and really asked, and they said no. So we have to just be what it is that we are today. So those are the kinds of questions to be, or kinds of solutions you can think about is creating the reality and building those steps to your aspirational world. I hope that was meaningful or helpful. Amy.
Yeah, I would agree with that. As I talked a little bit about it, sometimes you have to say no, but you don't want to seem like an obstacle. And I do get complaints about, well, we don't have enough resources, we don't have enough of this or that. And I always say, I get you, I hear you. So let's think about what we can do. I'll go to my boss, I'll go to the dean of the libraries, I'll explain the situation and see if there's anything we can do. And sometimes, yeah, I do have to come back and say, well, we're not going to be able to do that right now, but maybe we can brainstorm on kind of a short-term solution. It won't be the perfect solution, but maybe there's just something we can do to at least help alleviate the problem. And the advocating, it does make people in the library see the value of you, of your department. But then yes, they want you, and you just have to be diplomatic about it and say, you know what, that's awesome. Thank you so much for thinking of us, but right now we can't really do that. And then kind of offer an alternate solution. Well, maybe we could do this in a few months. And I found that works really well.
The boundary question.
Yeah.
We're right at time, unfortunately. So I wanted to make sure I wrap up because wanted to share that I'm hoping that this becomes a series. We talked about it in the seminars committee, and I sent in a proposal maybe next time talk about working with development and personnel management, et cetera. So there should be a conversation that continues from this. So I want to thank so much all of you for a whole... Oh, yes, and thank you. We were hoping that maybe we have a discussion around... We have mentoring in RBMS, and maybe there could be a way to develop a list of department heads who are willing to be mentors to others. So that's something that might be coming up. And then lastly, I just again want to thank our sponsor, Liberanticus. Thank you for being here. And I want to then also thank our panelists for sending us away with their experiences and advice.